Senate Land Use and the Environment Committee. We're also calling this our six-month root canal committee because we're going to have just a little bit to do. Before we go into the joint committee hearing, I appreciate the indulgence of the House members in allowing the Senate committee just to organize. And so the first thing we're going to do is adopt rules. We're going to introduce committee bills, and then we'll move into the joint hearing. I appreciate all of you being here, and we'll get to Measure 37 in about 3 minutes, okay? So first thing I'd like to do is open a work session on adopting the Senate committee rules. Could you go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all of you should have in your stack, the senators among you should have in your stack, right underneath your agenda, a copy of the 2005 model Senate rules. If I'm not mistaken, these rules are exactly the same as they were last session, with the exception in Rule 12 that we now require 48 hours notice for posting agendas, whereas last session was 24 hours.
Thank you very much. Is there a motion on adopting the rules?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the rules as proposed.
Senator Atkinson has moved we adopt the rules as proposed. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Next I'd like to do is open a work session on adopting committee bills, a number of bills that our committee staff were described by legislative council member, and committee just does not indicate support or opposition for the bills. It's just a matter of courtesy that we're going to introduce them as committee bills. And if you could just read down the legislative council member only, that would be fine.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, each of you should have received a stack of LC drafts, on the top of which is a list of, I believe, 10 LC drafts, LC191, LC1026, LC1231, LC1287, LC1673, LC1674, LC1815, LC1816, LC1781, and LC1781-1, which, despite the -1, is actually a completely separate bill.
All right. Is there a motion to adopt the reference bills as committee bills? Can we get a motion on that,
Mr. Vice Chair? You're going to look for me for the next.
Yes, I think I am.
Mr. Chair, I would move the bills be adopted as a committee bill as proposed.
Okay, thank you. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, now let's move into a joint hearing on Measure 37, and I would certainly appreciate any wisdom from Representative Grodd, the chair of the House Committee, on this. It's our intention to go through with a number of the stakeholders what Measure 37 means, and we don't have a lot of time. We'd like to move through it quickly, and this is not intended to be a chance to say whether you're for it or against it or whether you think our land use system has worked or it hasn't worked, but the voters approved Measure 37 by a 61% margin, and it is law. It became law on December 2nd, and I think it would be very helpful for this committee to hear from all those impacted how they feel about implementing Measure 37, what it means, whether we need to modify it, where any suggestions as to where the legislative body ought to go in addressing Measure 37. So that's what this hearing is about today, and I would very much appreciate it if William Shetterly, Commissioner, could come and kick this off.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Chairs, members of the committees. For the record, Wayne Federley, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Pleased to be here with you this afternoon. To lead off your discussion of ballot measure 37, I will try to be brief today. I have spoken at several conferences addressing the measure and have taken as much as an hour to do it. Obviously, you don't have that kind of time today, and I think that your hearing today will be most benefited by hearing from a broad range of perspectives on the measure, so I'll try not to occupy an inordinate amount of your time on the measure today. I think what I would like to do, if I may, with my time, would be just a quick walkthrough of the measure, identify some of the key key issues that we have addressed or are addressing at the state, and then also explain to you what we are doing just in terms of the claims process at the state and how that is progressing. And I'll begin in reverse order. When the measure was passed, The first order that we saw at the state level was to develop a claims process to have in place and ready to go on December 2nd, which was the effective date of the measure. There was a work group assembled through the Department of Administrative Services, the Governor's Office, the Department of Justice, and several of the affected or potentially affected state agencies under the measure. And that work group developed what has come to be adopted as a state administrative rule through the Department of Administrative Services and a state claims form. The governor asked me late in the month of November to assist in the coordination of the state response. We thought that was important because the potential scope of ballot measure 37 extends likely well beyond the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The breadth of the definition of land use regulation in the measure encompasses expressly and implicitly several state agencies. And we thought it was important that the state have a single coordinated rule and filing claims filing process so that we were not treating claimants differently depending on whether they were coming in with a claim against the Forestry Department or a claim against DLCD or a claim against the Agriculture Department in the statutes. And so that was the purpose of the state rule at one level, was to create a coordinated state process. Since the claims reach potentially well beyond DLCD, we decided that it made the most sense to designate the Department of Administrative Services as the central receiver of claims for that is, claims based on state regulations. Under the rule that has been adopted by the state, the function at DAS is to make an initial evaluation of a claim that comes in, and then determine whether it is sufficiently complete, that is, has enough information in order to evaluate it under the measure. DAS makes that initial cut as to completeness, and then under the process that we have established with the state, farms out the claim to what's called the regulating entity, and that will be the entity that has the basic jurisdictional authority over the subject matter of the claim. Clearly, if it is a claim that's based on Chapter 215 of the revised statutes that address farm and forest lands that come under the Department of Land Conservation and Development, that claim would come to us for substantive evaluation. If it's a claim based on the forestry statute, it would go to the Department of Forestry and the like. So then each regulating entity would have the function of making a substantive evaluation of the claim and then a determination either to compensate or to waive according to processes that are still under construction in each of those regulating entities. That, in a nutshell, is a description of the state claims process. As of last week, we had 69 state claims filed. I believe all but two of those were directed, will be ultimately directed to the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I think two involved forestry regulations. I think this was Thursday of last week, 23 of those claims had been vetted and determined to be sufficiently complete by DAS to be forwarded to our department. And so we've had, as of last week, 69 in, 23 determined to be complete, and more on the way, frankly. That's not to say that the remainder have been determined to be insufficient. It's just that that's where we are in the evaluation process. The state rule is a fairly straightforward rule. As you've probably read in the paper and may hear today in testimony, different jurisdictions around the state, local governments, have taken different approaches to what they require. Typically, points of at issue in some of the regulations. One would be, does the regulation require a filing fee? The state claims process does not require a filing fee. I should mention that that's not a reflection of a determination that a filing fee is or is not permitted under the measure. For the state, that's simply a function of state budget law. DAS doesn't have budget authority by the legislature to receive a fee or an account in which to deposit. So the state process does not require a filing fee. The state process does not require the filing of an appraisal, as some local jurisdictions do require. Another issue that you often see and may hear some about today, some local jurisdictions have expressly created third-party actions under their local ordinances so that if a decision is made not to apply a land use regulation to a property owner, that surrounding property owners may be given under some ordinances an express right of action if their property values are affected. The state rule does not provide for that kind of private right of action. It's a fairly straightforward rule and claims process. Even at that, now that we have had about a month, a little over a month of experience in claims coming in, we initiated a review last week of the claims rule and process, frankly, to make sure that we were not excluding claims based on the rule that really should be processed. If you think about it, the claims process was developed before we had any experience with what claims actually were going to look like coming in. And now with this first 60-plus claims that have come in, we're using those to go back and review the rule to make sure that we have not created any barriers too stringent for claims that really should be processed. We don't want the claims process to be a barrier to claims that should be evaluated on their merits for compensation under the measure. We are also coordinating with the with local governments. You should have at your desks some correspondence that we have sent out from the department, and also a joint letter from the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties. We are doing our level best to stay in close communication with local governments because a lot of these claims are going to require coordination. As you know, many of our state land use rules, particularly those that come under the jurisdiction of my department, as well as the statutes which we administer, have local components, that is, local ordinances drafted or enacted to implement state statutes or statewide goals and administrative rules. That being the case, we want to make sure that we are closely coordinating with local governments so that we're not creating a whipsaw kind of situation for claimants who may, and I'll get to this in a second, require a waiver or a non-application decision both by local government as well as state government. I am meeting weekly along with attorney from the Department of Justice and Ray Knapp from the Governor's Office with representatives of AOC and the League of Oregon Cities. We stay in touch on that weekly basis. And as you can see from one of the documents that I distributed to you, it's a letter of December 23, we actually sent a joint letter out to cities and counties from the League, from the Association, and from the state, encouraging them to communicate with their respective organizations so that we are all aware as much as possible of what kind of claims are coming in and what kind of action is out there in the communities. In the interest of time, I'll leave it at that, I think, for our claims coordination and just spend a few minutes with a quick walkthrough of the measure and some of the issues that you likely will hear about today. Just a word of disclaimer first. I practiced law for 23 years, but now I am a client. As director of the department, my lawyers are in the Justice Building, in the Robertson Building, in the Department of Justice. So I will be able to tell you today what I know from them. I will be very limited in my ability to guess or to anticipate legal advice that we have asked for in many cases, but have not yet received. But I think for today's purposes, probably what you're doing is issue spotting as much as anything, and I can set the stage for that with a walkthrough of the measure, and then you'll hear testimony from other witnesses I know with specific issues.
Director Satterlee, the AG's office is working with you and putting together an opinion.
The Department of Justice So far, I think we're not anticipating a compendium opinion like we got out of ballot measure 7. I think what we are anticipating is more a legal advice in real time, that is responding to questions as they present and as they come in, with advice being given by the Department of Justice and then implemented by us. I think we are not going to see the kind of 60 or 70 page opinion on measure 37 that we saw on measure 7.
When might that be?
Well, Mr. Chair, some of the opinions actually are already embedded in the claims process. For instance, they talked about whether or not the state would require a filing fee. Obviously, that decision was based on legal advice. The claims process also incorporates the Department of Justice's determination that the process for filing a claim is not a contested case proceeding that requires a hearing before the Department of Administrative Services or the regulating entities. It is a proceeding what's called other than a contested case that doesn't implement the full range of hearing rights that you have in a contested case. Those opinions are already embedded in what you see in the rule. We have indicated a couple of other things specific to the measure that are reflected in the governor's directive to local governments early on after the measure, that the state would look critically at what we're calling blanket waivers, that is, local ordinances that would purport to grant waivers across the board to all property owners in a certain class without requiring, for instance, the filing of an application and demonstration, restriction on property, and a diminution in value. That reflects advice from the Department of Justice, as well as, I think, week before last, determination that the Department, in the opinion of the Department of Justice, one question that was coming on at us strongly and repeatedly was whether or not what we're calling waivers under the measure are transferable with the property. We asked for the Department of Justice's opinion on that. We don't have anything in writing, but the upshot of their opinion was that a decision by a local government to not apply a land use regulation to a particular property is in the nature of a personal right to the property owner and does not vest with the property. It does not transfer with the property. There are subsets of questions beyond that, such as then what have you if a property owner makes an application, builds a house on the property pursuant to a decision by a local government not to apply a particular land use regulation, and then sells the property with the house built. Likely what you have is some form of a non-conforming use at that point that doesn't make it illegal, but is something less than a fully conforming use. It creates more issues, I think, when you've got somebody who, pursuant to a decision not to apply a land use regulation, subdivides their property into quarter-acre parcels or urban density parcels and then sells them as vacant ground. What can a property owner who acquires that do on those properties? And that second set of questions have not been answered fully by the Department of Justice, but they have made the initial determination that a decision by a local government to not apply a land use regulation is a decision that is personal to the owner of the property who makes the application and does not attach to and transfer with the property itself.
Does that mean that one of the poster childs of this whole issue, Dorothy English, can't subdivide?
Of course, the question whether she can subdivide is even a harder question in terms of and we'll probably hear some of that today, as to whether subdivision is encompassed within the range of land use regulations to which the measure applies. Assuming that she can, then the real issue is, can she transfer unimproved property, which her children then would be able to build on after the transfer? That's an open question. clearly, if she transfers the property and builds the houses, the children, there would be no abatement required. Nobody would have to tear that house down, but it is an open question. And frankly, we are waiting for those answers, and we'll be happy to share them with you as soon as we have them from the department. You'll probably hear several opinions on that today from the other witnesses. It's an unknown at this point under the terms of the measure.
Thank you.
If you'd like, just a rundown of the measure itself.
We've got a lot of people set to go, and I'd like to get out of here at 5. So maybe just 3 more minutes summarizing what you think the open issues are. That would be wonderful.
Well, I'll tell you another one that we have that is a question that we've asked for advice on and we expect to be receiving shortly, but I'll tell you I'm not anticipating a clear answer under the measure. And you'll hear it today, I'm sure, because in the folks that I have met with over the past 6 weeks, it's been a recurring question, and that is who has the authority to make a decision to remove, modify, or not apply a land use regulation, particularly where you have this overlay between state and local regulations. If a property owner files an application with a county for relief under a county ordinance and obtains a decision from the county to not apply, a county ordinance that was enacted pursuant to a state requirement, is that sufficient, or does the property owner have to file a separate claim with the state in order to obtain a decision from the state not to apply the state regulation? That's one of the iterations of that question. As I have gone around to various forums that have discussed the measure and listened to attorneys and interested parties on all sides, I think the consensus is that until there is a clear answer, perhaps from the legislature or through litigation, if that's what it takes, the best practice is to, where you have the potential application of both a state and a local regulation, the best answer is to be safe and apply in both places. That's not based on a legal determination at this point, but is by consensus at least the safest way to go. A subset of that question is, in the case of state statutes, who has authority to waive? In one place, the measure talks about the governing body that enacted the regulation. Clearly, when you're talking about state statutes, it's the legislature that has enacted those statutes, some of which apply directly to property. How is that implemented in terms of an application to modify, remove, or not apply? Does a local government have the authority to waive that state statute? Does a state administrative agency have the authority to waive a state statute over which it has administrative jurisdiction? Or does that decision have to be made somehow by the legislature? Again, an open question, and one that it does not come clearly under the terms of the measure.
I just want to say one more minute.
Okay, that's fine. I appreciate that. Other issues that you may hear about today that are of concern that will require some clarification, and that would be the extent to which the extent of the exemptions under the measure. Some of the exemptions are very explicit. Some of them are very broad. And it remains to be determined, for instance, where the measure says that it does not apply to regulations required to comply with federal law. It's not exactly clear what that means. Does that mean, in fact, where the regulation has been enacted as a result of a specific requirement of federal law? Is it sufficient if the regulation has been enacted as a an element as a required element in a delegated program, that is a program that's been delegated to the state for which the state has accepted delegation from the federal government, or where perhaps a regulation may be required as a condition of funding, federal dollars. Are those lower state and local regulations comprehended within that exemption of they're required to comply with federal law? Mr. Chair, I think in fairness to everybody else, and since since this, I think, is intended primarily for some issue spotting, I'll defer to the other witnesses to speak. I certainly will remain in the room if you have questions for me at a wrap-up, anytime you want us back. Again, this is an iterative process. We are developing further clarification as we go, and I will keep you apprised, both Senator Ringo and Representative Girard, as we get clarification from the Department of Justice on some of these specific questions that I have raised and that others will raise today, so that you know where we're going.
Thank you. Any questions from the Representative?
Just a short question, Mr. Director. I know that most local jurisdictions seem to require an appraisal. If I understand, the state does not. Could you give us a rationale for that? And if that is not going to be the standard at the state level, how do you protect the state from frivolous, misstated, or fraudulent claims?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the determination at the state level, I'm trying to remember, was derived, I believe, from Chapter 293. It was and that again, like the filing fee, was a determination by the Department of Justice that simply by virtue of state statute, the state doesn't have the authority to require the filing of an appraisal with a claim. That decision does not necessarily extend as a something that we would consider to be a binding opinion on local governments. That is particular to state statutes and the state claims process. We do have in our rule the ability of the Department of Administrative Services or the regulated entity to initiate an appraisal if we believe an appraisal is called for and necessary based on the information that's been submitted with a claim.
Any other questions for Director Jones? Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your help. The next witness I'd like to ask forward is Hector McPherson, former state senator, one of the architects of Senate Bill 100. Thanks very much for coming here today. And
we're pleased to be here.
There may have been a little miscommunication. There was some question of getting a long background of our land use system, and I really think is what we're trying to do is focus on what is Measure 37 and where do we go from here. But I'd be pleased to hear from you.
Well, I understood my mandate was to study, give you a short history of land use planning, particularly as it relates to Measure 37.
Well, we'll have to be a little flexible, but let's start and see where we go.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Hector McPherson, and I've been asked to give a short history of land use planning as it relates to the passage of Measure 37 in the November election. As the principal sponsor of both Senate Bill 100 and Senate Bill 101 in the 1973 legislative session, I am one of the few individuals left standing who participated in the passage of this epic legislation. For better or for worse, I have watched and usually participated in the battles that have been fought to preserve Oregon's legacy since then. To begin the history, I should note that land use planning in Oregon did not begin with 1973, with the passage of Senate Bill 100. It had a long and somewhat surprising origin. Actually, it was a bunch of farmers. Although the city zoning was authorized in 1919, the legislature did not authorize county zoning until 1947. It then lay dormant until 1961, when Representative Warren Smith, a farmer from Benton County, proposed a relationship between property taxes and zoning. It was known as the Greenbelt Law and assessed farmland at its true cash value for farm use, not its market value, influenced by development potential. In 1962, it affected only the Eola Hills in Polk County and reduced property taxes by 48% from the preceding year. In 1963, the law was revised extensively into the EFU concept, much as we know have it today. It brought a tremendous stimulation of interest in zoning for rural areas. By 1967, an OSU extension agent by the name of Ted Sador came coming from Union County with a slideshow and a message: we must save our best farmland or suffer its inevitable loss. In 1968, the Interim Committee on Agriculture, chaired by Representative Joe Rogers, a dairy farmer, proposed Senate Bill 10 after Dean Wilbur Cooney of OSU suggested they listen to Ted Sador. The 1969 legislature passed Senate Bill 10, providing Oregon with a first step by mandating planning for all cities and counties, with zoning to be accomplished by December 31st, 1971. Governor Tom McCall signed it, declaring an urban explosion of environmental pollution is threatening the livability of Oregon in such a manner that effective land use planning and zoning have become a statewide, not merely a local concern. This is where things were in 1971 when I first came to the Senate. Some counties have worked diligently to prepare plans. Some have not. There was no coordination between the counties and state agencies with planning responsibilities, such as ODOT. The governor had been given lots of power, but no money and no staff to do anything. I saw the need and put together a task force that, with the assistance of Bob Logan and assistant to Tom McCall. Senate Bill 100 was the work of this group. Senate Bill 100, the headline bill, created the framework for the Oregon system. It did not in itself bring up the fairness issue that became the central theme in the passage of Measure 37. It would be the Land Conservation Development Commission, acting under its regulatory powers granted and supervised by the legislature, that brought the public reaction. Not a session went by that didn't tinker with land use and grant additional permitted uses in the exclusive farm use zone. This said, it does not excuse me and other supporters of land use planning who can be blamed for believing that land use planning is the only rational way to allocate a scarce land resource. We have been in the thick of the battle to preserve farmland, protect the environment, and generally keeping Oregon green and clean. In 1973, my greatest concern was an issue not addressed in Senate Bill 100. This I spoke to when I sponsored Senate Bill 101, the companion bill to Senate Bill 100. This is the bill that was aimed directly at the fairness issue. It provided the incentives to farmers for allowing their land to be placed in exclusive farm use zones. In the words of the law in ORS 215-243, exclusive land use zoning is provided by law, substantially limits alternatives to the use of rural land, and the importance of rural lands to the public justifies incentives and privileges offered to encourage owners of rural lands to hold such lands in exclusive farm use zones. It then went on to list what these incentives and privileges were. There were three tax reduction measures proposed. One, special assessment of farmland requiring a change for assessing it on fair market value to assessing it on a compounded farm use value. This reduced property taxes on farmlands by 50 to 80%. Two, inheritance taxes were to be based on farm use value rather than the market value. Third, the taxes levied on sewer and water districts were not to be applied to land zoned exclusively for farm use. It was my intention to tie all tax benefits to the loss of development rights, but because not all farmland was exclusively farm use zoned at the time, I couldn't eliminate the yearly application process for unzoned land. The bill also included Oregon's first right to farm provision and tied them to the EFU provision. It restricted the ability of governments to put unreasonable restrictions on accepted farming practices in EFU zones. This is the bill that made EFU zoning acceptable to farmers and eventually made the Oregon Farm Bureau a believer in farmland preservation. The legislature made significant changes in the administration of Goals 3 and 4 governing agriculture and forestry in the 1993 session when it adopted House Bill 3661. This was the one major revision to the law since its adoption in 1973. I will attempt to recount the numerous changes that were made as a result of 3661. Here, except to note the substitution of an expanded law of record for the small-scale agriculture rules adopted by the LCDC. This allowed for one lot of record dwelling to be allowed on each tract that existed on July 1, 1985. Additional restrictions applied to high-value land. This was the one serious attempt by the legislature to respond to the growing concerns of the fairness issue. To summarize, rural land use planning has evolved in the last 40 years from a totally free market economy to a tightly controlled system of regulation that makes winners and losers. I would argue that the broad society has been the biggest winner. Agriculture generates over $10 billion in direct and related income. It is a stable industry, thanks in part to a stable land base. We have compact cities, protected wetlands, abundant wildlife, scenic vistas that please the eye. We have also created losers, the most obvious of which are the people who have bought real property hoping to build a house and enjoy the ambience of country living. These are the people who convinced 60% of the voters, 61% actually, to support Measure 37. I would argue that the rebellion we experienced was bigger than that generated by land use planning. It reflected unhappiness with the tightly controlled society that we have become. Environmental laws that restrict what trees can be cut, what chemicals can be used, and when trash can be burned all figure in. Much was made of Oregonians in action in the recent campaign about the provision in Senate Bill 100 for the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use to study and make recommendations on implementing a program of compensation due to the loss of value to landowners. I know just where this provision came from. This was added by the LBDA subcommittee in a compromise hammered out with the significant lobbyists that I name them, Fred Bernada for the Home Builders, Ward Armstrong representing AOI, and Gordon Fultz for the Association of Oregon Counties. Senate Bill 100 was signed into law on May 29th of that year, and Senate Bill 101, the companion bill, was not debated and voted on until almost a month later. It could not have been known by the LBDA committee that fairness would be addressed there. This completes my mandate to explain the history of land use in Oregon as it relates to Measure 37, with a minimum of opinion thrown in. I, of course, have many opinions and on what should be due now, but will forego giving those unless asked.
Thank you very much for that overview. That was very useful. Committee, are there any questions for Senator McPherson?
Welcome, Senator McPherson. Thank you and your wife very much for sending such an able son to join our body. I think I read that you're one of the litigants in a suit to test the measure, some limits of Measure 37. Could you just describe a little bit, very briefly, what's...
Describe what was that now?
I think I remember that you were one of the litigants in a suit.
Yes. I think Measure 37 is maybe fatally flawed, but that really doesn't excuse. I think we have to do something regardless of what happens to Measure 37. The people when they voted, 61%, said we've got to do something serious about land use planning. And what I found when I was out on the campaign trail was the people said, you know, we haven't gotten any satisfaction on any loosening up. And certainly we've got to look at those kinds of things. And we could make it a whole lot fairer to everybody if we went in that direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Well, it's good to see you again, former colleague on LCDC and any number of things. My question is, you mentioned that the tax benefits for the land were quite substantial, the tax reduction for keeping land in farmland. And would you share with the committee what the requirement is for people who, for whatever means they had, they took their land out of farm production, whether they rezoned or became an exception area or whatever, wasn't there a requirement that some of those back taxes be repaid?
Well, you know, I'm not up on the more recent things, Senator Burdick. You know, back in my day, it was you gave 10 years of back taxes. You know, but when we're looking at a complete change of use that was brought by something like this, I think we ought to look at the total tax bill that has been over the time that that particular individual had owned the land. Anyway, that would be certainly fairer to me to look at the entire tax bill. Now, there's been over $1 billion in lost state income because we have EFU zoning. I think it's done its work. But the difficulty is that we have people that want all the tax breaks, and then they also want to be able to subdivide their land when things turn sour on them. So that's really all I can give you on that.
So it's kind of a windfall both ways.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming to testify. Harlan Levy, are you there and available to testify? And just to mention, it's Tom Gallagher, are you here? Let's see here. How about, let's start with Harlan. And then we'll follow after Harlan, we'll go, Tim Martinez and Tim Sherman, if that's okay. Incidentally, Ross Day of Oil Gunions in Action slipped me a note saying he has to be out till 4:30 so we can talk about him until then and he can't hear us. I guess, seriously though, I would like to give them a chance at the end. Certainly he's aware of some of these issues, of the ambiguities, and we'll give him an opportunity to respond after he returns at 4:30. That's Harlan.
Thank you, Chair Ringo. Chair Girard. Members of the two committees, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, senior staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm distributing some written testimony. I'll try not to repeat too much of that. Some of it goes a little bit beyond the scope of this hearing from the chair's comments earlier. So I encourage you to read that at your own leisure. The Oregon Association of Realtors represents approximately 15,000 realtors around the state of Oregon. And we did not take a position on ballot measure 37. However, its passage will significantly affect the way our members conduct business. So we are very interested in assisting the legislature in trying to implement this measure. And I thank you for inviting me here today to give you some ideas on what we think the legislature can do to improve on what the voters have done in this past election. What realtors do is they help their clients buy and sell real estate. And in order for them to do their jobs, they require a stable and a predictable real estate market. As a result, realtors support zoning in general because zoning is designed to create predictability and certainty in the market. And zoning was originally created to protect property value. That's why jurisdictions got together and started doing it back at the turn of the last century. However, we have become concerned over the years with Oregon's unique statewide land use planning system because it has taken the idea of zoning and changed it around so that it has actually destroyed value in many cases. I'm going to talk a little bit about where we see the ballot measure itself and leave the rest along those lines for you to read at your own leisure. We think that the vote for ballot measure 37 was a vote for land use reform, and it was not a vote merely for compensation. You heard Senator McPherson mention to you that when he was on the campaign trail during the campaign, that's what he heard from people that he talked to. And we think that this is an opportunity for the legislature to finally deal with the inequities and the unfairness that we have found that our members have discovered dealing with their clients through the land use planning program. This presents an opportunity for you to finally deal with the program, the land use planning program that has in many cases destroyed property owners' reasonable investment-backed expectations. We would encourage you not to look at this as a vote merely for compensation. You will hear testimony from witnesses on Wednesday, a lot of record issue that would be before you, where most landowners merely want to use their property in the way that they had intended when they purchased it. After they purchased it, in many cases, the laws were changed. Regulations were adopted, statutes were passed, and most of the time, prior to 1998, these landowners didn't even receive notice that their rights had been significantly affected by these changes. So we would ask that you look at Measure 37's passage, not with an eye towards compensation, rather with an eye towards reforming the land use planning program. I would like to give you a few examples of how we think it would be a terrible mistake for you to focus merely on compensation. And we have seen a bill that has already been introduced that would ask you to do that. First, if you focus on compensation without reforming the land use program, what you will be doing is institutionalizing this unfairness. This program has been going for over 30 years now. The unfairness has grown significantly over the years. If you were to create a compensation fund with a new funding source, for example, to pay claims, all that you would be doing is institutionalizing the unfairness and then asking people to pay for that unfairness. We would argue that that is not the response that the voters would like you to take after its passage. Second, we believe that, you know, with the legislature's limited budget resources, you should be using these resources on more appropriate things. Thirdly, we think that if you were to talk about compensation funds and creating new types of payment for compensation, that inevitably will lead to the talk of new taxes, and these taxes might be tied in some way to real estate. And again, we think that the voters would not take too kindly based on their response to two recent tax votes in the last 2 years. The second thing that we would ask that you take from the passage of Measure 37 is that you require some uniformity in the processing of claims. You have some jurisdictions that are welcoming claimants with open arms, places where the statewide land use planning program was not popular to begin with. These jurisdictions are doing everything they can to bring landowners in to file claims. You have other jurisdictions that are adopting every means at their disposal to dissuade landowners from bringing claims. We would argue that the role of the legislature should be to try to bring the two sides to the middle so that there is one uniform process. You heard Director Shetterly talk about the state process, which we think is a very fair process. Something along those lines ought to be required for the local jurisdictions that are implementing this at the local level. The third thing that we think the legislature should do after the passage of Measure 37 is to specify that a waiver of a land use regulation, if it is granted, is an outright permitted use. It then would run with the land upon transfer of that property to a new landowner.
That way Dorothy English could subdivide.
Yes, Chair Ringo, that would allow her to subdivide and then allow those lots to then be transferred to a new party without the fear that at some later point the county would claim those lots were illegally created. Absolutely. We think that there is much uncertainty and unpredictability right now. The ballot measure was not clear on this issue, and we think the legislature would be good for the legislature to clarify this, that if a waiver is granted or a variance is granted, that does become a property right that then runs with the land. You may hear testimony from financial institutions later. They are wary of any of these things because they don't know what the predictability is and they're worried about their security. We think that there are a lot of problems created by this unpredictable nature of a waiver. We think the legislature could fix this problem.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a question? So to take away uncertainty, it could equally be uncertain to say that the waiver didn't follow with the land.
Chair,
provide equal certainty.
Chair Ringo, Representative Blumenk, right now the measure is silent on this issue, so it is an uncertain situation we find ourselves in right now, and the courts could fall on either side of this, frankly. We think the legislature should take this bull by the horns before we get into a litigation scenario and specify that it does create an outright permitted use that runs with the land.
May I follow? Yeah, but my question is, if we specified that it did not go with the land, that would provide certainty as well, is that right?
Senator Ringo, Representative Ringo, that would, but it would undermine the entire measure, and you would find yourselves facing the son of Measure 37 or the grandson of Measure 7, and the process would continue. We hope that the legislature does not make that decision.
So it isn't just certainty, it's the outcome.
Senator Ringo, Representative Ringo, yes. Finally, we would ask that the legislature delegate the authority to state agencies and local governments to make the decision to either not apply or waive the land use regulation that you heard Director Shetterly refer to earlier. That, again, is ambiguous in the ballot measure itself. In one section, it seems to infer that they have that ability. In another section, it seems to infer that they don't have that ability. The legislature would be well served to clarify that and specifically delegate that authority, which you do have the right to do. In conclusion, this is the second time that we're facing the situation. Voters passed Measure 7 in 2000 that was a similar ballot measure. They passed Measure 37 in 2004 with 61% of the votes. We do look at this as an opportunity to finally have an honest debate on the land use planning program. There are several issues, several areas where this legislature could make responsible and reasonable reforms to the program that would not gut Oregon's land use planning program. I've heard that cliche used many times, but would provide for some fairness in the system. I know that the chair plans on having a hearing Wednesday regarding the lot of record issue. We will be bringing forward a lot of record bill, a bill that we think will alleviate much of the tension that has built up behind this program in the rural parts of the state. Some of the other issues that we think the legislature ought to be looking at is finally some secondary lands legislation for our non-productive farmland that have been zoned as farmland in places outside of the Willamette Valley. Also, we need to have an honest discussion about our urban growth boundaries. They have been changed. The whole purpose of having an urban growth boundary when they were created was for a planning tool to assist planners as they wanted to expand in an efficient manner. Urban growth boundaries have in many cases become impossible to move. They've become brick walls, and that was never the intention. So these are some areas that we hope this legislature will look at when you're dealing with land use through this committee and through the body as a whole. With that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Committee, any questions?
Mr. Chair, I have a brief. Harlan, would your realtors have a sense that an annexation action by a city could produce action under Measure 37?
Chairman Ringo, Chair Garrod, Representative Greenwood. Probably not, because when you're annexing property, you're probably increasing the value. You're bringing it inside of the city, so therefore you're going to be allowing for more development options. I would argue that, it doesn't restrict. It's a regulation, but it does not restrict the use of property, nor would it cause a devaluation of that property. So I think it'd be hard to find a claim under that type of scenario.
Okay, Congressman.
Yes. Are you thinking of any area in particular?
I'd ask others about that. It's your assertion that being in the city increases the value of property, but that's something to be, I assume that's something that would be assumed by whatever other claims are made under Measure 37, but could the 40,000 citizens of, say, Bethany file each a claim under Measure 37 if they were forcibly annexed?
Senator Ringo, Representative Garrod, Representative Greenlink, anybody is free to file any claim. The question is, do they have a Measure 37 claim that would result in a depreciation of their property value? Would they have an appraisal that shows that their property has been devalued by this government action? And would they be successful in the filing of their claim? I don't know what the outcome would be, but I would argue it's probably going to be difficult for them to show that they've lost value if they're being annexed and they're allowed more additional uses they otherwise were not allowed prior to the annexation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Harlan.
Thank you.
Just a comment, both to the committee and the audience. We have a lot of people on this list, and we have 60 minutes, so I'm going to be a little bit brutal in terms of keeping people in time just so that we're out of here by 5 o'clock. We could stay till midnight talking about a land use system, but I'm not going to. And so please don't think I'm rude if I cut people off to speed people along here. But why don't we have Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman come. And next we'll put up John Chandler and hear about how things were in Disney World.
Disney World?
Yes, he's in Florida.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committees. Thank you for putting us in front of John Chandler. You know how much that means to us. Again, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. To my right is Ken Sherman, Jr., longtime counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. We'll help you get back on time. Ken has some very brief remarks. But I would tell you, when I look around the dais up there, you know, we have banks in every one of your cities. And while Oregonians passed it at 61%, and we've got to implement this issue, it's a matter of how it's going to work in Klamath Falls and Eugene, Woodburn, Silverton, Beaverton, what have you. So that's the biggest concern, is how we're going to continue lending in the state. And with that, I will turn it over to Ken Sherman, Jr.
Thank you. I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. And I'll tell you that Oregon banks are just now beginning to learn about Measure 37, but even at this early stage in our educational process, it's become apparent that the measure raises a number of important questions and potential problems for financial institutions and for others who make loans that are secured by or are somehow otherwise involved in real property. One of the key features, we believe, in Measure 37 is that the rights that arise under the provisions are personal to the property owner and do not, as we read the measure, run with the land. Thus, if a property owner makes a Measure 37 claim and gets the land use regulations waived, permitting him to divide previously restricted property that was only permitted to be used for farm use, and if the owner borrows a couple of million dollars from the bank to finance a subdivision of that property, the bank needs to take into consideration the fact that if the owner defaults on that financing during the development process and the bank forecloses, it may very well not be permitted to complete the development. The measure doesn't tell us what will happen under those circumstances, and unless the legislature act, it seems to us that the courts are ultimately going to have to respond to questions of that nature. As we read Measure 37, it's not even clear that once a land use restriction is waived in response to a claim and the previously prohibited development, such as the building of a non-farm dwelling on EFU land, is completed, that the government couldn't require the house to be torn down when it is sold to an unrelated third party. That seems a stretch to me, but until that kind of confusion in the law is cleared up, I think you can expect that mortgage lenders are going to be very nervous. While most of the discussion about Measure 37 has focused on rural farm and forest lands, the measure has potential impact on really every single property in Oregon. Cities are constantly fine-tuning their zoning and other land use regulations, and each such adjustment that arguably reduces the value of effective property may conceivably generate a Measure 37 claim. Prudent lenders may well in the future resort to Measure 37 audits at an increased expense to borrowers. Even where there is no potential Measure 37 claim with respect to a property, its owners and the property and the owner's lender may be substantially impacted by the workings of the measure. For example, if Farmer Jones has 100 acres of crop land that is next door to a property, the owner of which gets the non-farm restrictions waived and puts in a subdivision, so you've got a subdivision next to a farm, the presence of those new homes next to the farm may make it more difficult or expensive for Jones to continue farming, and that, of course, is going to create problems for Jones' lender as well as for Jones himself. Another example of the impact, the indirect impact of Measure 37 that could cause problems for rural property lenders is that as the measure opens up new development opportunities for previously restricted properties, this may significantly depress the values of similar properties that weren't development restricted prior to Measure 37. This is just a brief sampling of some of the issues that we see kind of bubbling up to the surface as we look at this from the standpoint of the lending community. We believe this measure can be characterized as something of a minefield for both property owners and for those who take security interests in real property. And it's obvious that the Oregon voters have spoken with a strong voice about this issue of compensation and reform, as it's been mentioned earlier. I think it's now up to the legislature to take that lead and move forward to give us some answers to some of these questions. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. My question is, I think you answered it, but do you think it's important for the legislature to address this issue this session?
I think there's going to be a great deal of uncertainty, Mr. Chairman, unless and until the legislature or the courts address these things. I think in the nature of things, the courts are going to be will take a long time to really address these in a thorough manner. I would hope the legislature could provide us with the answers during this session.
Okay. Thank you.
Kay, what's your position on the transfer of the claim?
Well, I have not given my client a position in terms of legally I believe there is or is not a transfer. Frankly, my own reading of the measure is I have great doubt that transfer is provided for in the measure, and I think that is something that needs to be clarified by the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So to sum it up, do you think that there's at least a risk that farmers who are not either not affected by Measure 37 or do not choose to avail themselves of it because of what's going on around them, they could actually see their financing for their farm operation put in jeopardy because of uncertainty about how neighboring decisions will affect their farms?
Well, Madam, Mr. Chairman, Madam Senator Burdick, we're going to work very hard and try and be very creative to keep those farmers in business. But I do worry about the impact of urban activity next door to the farm. We've seen as our communities have expanded out into the farm areas all up and down the valley, the impacts that those can have. And so we see this as a hodgepodge kind of a thing where if your family has been on this piece of property for a long time and it's next door to somebody who just bought this farm yesterday, this group has rights that group doesn't have, and you can have this checkerboard square of farming and urban development that I think is going to be very difficult to manage and is going to create some financing problems.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. John Chandler, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committees, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. Just flew in last night from Orlando, which is what the Disney World reference was to. The National Association of Home Builders was meeting there, and I in a shameless plea for sympathy, I'll tell you the most excitement I had was on the drive home from the airport when my car caught on fire. So, it was a heck of a ride. They figured out where to do that at Disneyland. They'd make a ton of money. The amazing amount of plastic in the engine compartment of an American vehicle, I found out. And off topic entirely, the rental car they gave me was a Toyota Prius. I got the joke. I'm not sure if anybody else did. I have a couple weeks worth of redemption before I go back to driving the gas guzzler. So, with regard to Measure 37, I think I commend you for having this conversation. I have a few points I want to mention, but I'll do so very briefly. The first is RACS. I've watched carefully since the thing passed and since December 3rd when it became effective, and I've not noticed any big chunks of the firmament falling on anybody. Yes, there are some concerns with the measure. There are good lawyers aplenty looking at it and getting baffled and stumped and advising the clients accordingly. But I don't think that this either committee needs to charge the hill just yet. I think it needs to be more thinking and talking and discussion before any particular action ought to happen. And I'm not so sure that if we didn't do anything, things wouldn't sort themselves out just fine in any event. The second point I'd like to make to you, and you're going to hear this over and over, is I think it's critical that we listen to the message being sent. Now, I have my own view of what that is. You have your views of what that is. I think the one thing we all agree upon is the mathematics of the election, where 61% of Oregonians said something. I think it's absurd to think that they were somehow confused on this initiative and smart on others. Therefore, I think we have to respect the fact that they did make a statement. Former Senator McPherson, I think, touched on a good chunk of the rationale that our land use system has simply gotten pretty hard. The rule is used to be, it was supposed to be easy to develop inside the boundary, hard to develop outside. The rules have over time morphed into a situation where it's become almost impossible outside the boundary and difficult inside. I think my personal view is that as the land use system shifted from a rural focus to an urban one, more and more people got caught up in what had previously been a free good. If you're a resident of Southwest Portland, for example, where I used to be, where I used to live, you can regulate happily being favor regulations that affected folks in Union County because you weren't living in Union County. But when the regulations came to increase density in your neighborhood or prohibit cul-de-sacs in your neighborhood or require townhomes in the neighborhood or set aside street side for environmental preservation in your neighborhood, that was different. I think you may hear about polling data saying that Oregon are willing to support the land use system. I believe they do. I also think there's polling data out there, because I've seen the polls and helped put them together, that say the Oregonians don't much understand what the land use system is, and they support it pretty much to the extent that it doesn't affect them, as they do taxes and other things. So it's not to say that the voters are any more mumbly about land use than they are about anything else. It's human nature. If my property is affected, it's bad. If your property is affected, that's probably a good thing, and you got to quit whining. The message behind Mile 37, I believe, was that there was a background noise of dissatisfaction with the system. I see 37, frankly, not as a cataclysm, but as an opportunity. And that's the third point I want to make, too. I think there are some things we can do this session. I don't think we need to rush into them. I would hope that we don't start scheduling hearings right away on what they might be, because all you'll do is fill up hearing rooms like we have today with people who are talking without thinking it through, including me. I've analyzed the measure. I have some thoughts on it. I'm not ready to put a bill forward or anything even remotely looking like that. But the opportunity we have is to take a look at some of the restrictions in Oregon land use that have brought us to this point. I think it may be healthy to think of it in terms of, not in terms of two Oregons, but in terms of the regulatory climate in rural Oregon, which is by and large prohibitory, and when you prohibit somebody from doing something, you're going to aggravate them, by and large, versus the regulatory climate in urban areas, which isn't supposed to be prohibitory. It's supposed to be, you can do it, but we've moved away from that. And I think this gives us an opportunity to talk about, is any acre farmland outside of the Inland Growth Boundary sacrosanct, and if so, fine. If not, can we relax some of the regulations on that? Inside of boundaries can make it easier to do the development that the boundary was designed to facilitate in the first place. That's just one idea of looking at it through that set of filters. I think there's an opportunity to clarify some of the things in the measure. You've heard about the transferability of waiver. I think that's an open question. I think whether or not a right to subdivide is a use under Oregon laws is another very good question. I have a couple others. I don't know if Burton Reeves and the women didn't notice, but this applies to cities and counties in the state. There's not quite a special district. Seems to me that they ought to get to join the fun, too. It's rude of us not to invite them. They get the feelings hurt if you don't bring them in, seems to me. I don't want that on my conscience. I think the issue of who gets to raise what piece of what thing is critical. One of the issues that has plagued this is a lack of understanding of what the proper role is between state and local government. We talked about this last session. We're going to talk about it again this session. This gives us an opportunity to talk about that. If the state thinks something's important but the local doesn't, then what? If the local thinks something important, the state doesn't care, then what? Who came up with the idea in the first place of a particular regulation and who gets to enforce it, whether you get paid for it, etc.? And looking behind the details is that relationship, the fundamental relationship between governmental entities, which we have lost sight of.
Excuse me, you talk very fast, but still you only get one more minute.
Well, I was going to sell you my car, too, if I'd like an advance. Fourth point, Mr. Chairman, and then penultimate point, is please do not confuse this process of Major 37 corrections with the big picture bill or the big look bill or the 30-year bill or whatever it gets called. I believe the governor is going to put that in or the department. That's the bill we had last session that would have set up a group of smart folks to look at our land use system and figure out what works and what doesn't, and whether Oregonians should buy into it. This is not that. I think this session, if I had my way, we would talk about basically two big bills. We would talk about Measure 37, if we can figure out a way to fix some of the disconnects, and we would talk about the big land use bill and review some of those big picture 30,000-foot issues. I would not, and I think it would be a huge mistake to confuse the two. Now, the last point I want to make is relax. This is a long session. I think this bill, yes, I've been practicing that since my car fell on the whiskey helps too, but that's probably appropriate for a legislative process. This will work itself out. I think we have a good committee structure this time. I'm pleased with the membership of the committees. I think we have people engaged now, focused. Unlike the Nation 7 conversation where there was still the slew on the rope to see whether or not the Supreme Court would throw it out or not, we have this. That changes the dynamic considerably in terms of the discussion. I think we have an opportunity to make some good changes. I'll take any questions you may have. Thank you very much.
I just like asking if he relaxed while his car was on fire.
After a brief moment after, I had to run a fire extinguisher before. It's pretty cool. It was big clouds. Yeah, fun. Little car on fire part.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from the government folks, please. Dan Cooper, Lynn Ludwig, and Art Schlack. He's gracious with your presence.
Sit down here.
Mr. Chair, Chair Ringo, Chair Dwyer, I have some very short notes that I want to work off of, and I'll try to keep this brief. My name is Dan Cooper. I serve as Metro's attorney. As you know, Metro does many things, but one of the things we do is we have some land use planning authority within the Portland metropolitan area where there is, because you gave it to us, it's also been confirmed by our voters in a home rule charter they adopted in 1992. And so we're part of the land use system. So Measure 37 affects us. So far, we have received no claims under Measure 37 directly that apply to any land inside our boundary. And that's not surprising to me, because what Metro has done with its land use authority, in addition to overseeing where the urban growth boundary is to adopt some requirements for local governments inside our boundary, which are mostly aimed at increasing the efficiency of land use and have upzone land rather than downzone land as a result of it. We do have a few areas where Measure 37 does have some impact on us. We have adopted some requirements for local governments to protect floodplains and streams for water quality purposes. Those regulations may be within one of the exceptions to Measure 37. They may not be. That's something that I think we're willing to relax, just like Mr. Chandler advised all of you, to wait and see how that all works out. It's not a major amount of land. We also have, as part of our urban growth boundary calculations, counted on local governments to restrict non-industrial use of industrial land. And in fact, in some cases, we required those governments to maintain those regulations in order to protect the industrial land base from encroachment by non-industrial users. Measure 37 does raise some serious questions as to how well we can count on that protection, and may cause over time some erosion and loss of industrial land for non-industrial uses. We had been working on a fish and wildlife habitat regulatory program to examine how the local governments inside our region, how well they had protected, and see whether those protections really made sense on a regional basis, because some streams cross jurisdictional boundaries, and if Gresham had protections on a stream, and then the stream flowed into Fairview didn't have protections, you might lose some of the benefits of that. So the question of, did we need to sort of levelize things across the region, was what we are working on.
Because
Measure 37 obviously has a great impact on our ability to adopt those future regulations. So our council has decided that in light of Measure 37, it won't do an old-fashioned regulatory scheme. Whatever regulations we're going to adopt will have to be done in a fashion that does not diminish property values. And there are ways you actually can do that if you talk to the technical people about how development occurs. It's much more of how land is developed than whether it is or how intensively. You're going to have to allow people to use the land for what they could use it before,
You're going to have to see if you can have some engineering solutions to make sure that the environment isn't damaged. The biggest impact on Metrel from 37 is just how do we predict the future? Our job is to calculate long-term planning needs for the region, determine what the urban growth boundary should be based on long-range forecasts for both need for land and supply of land. And what Measure 37 does is create a tremendous amount of uncertainty as to what development patterns will be in the future. We don't know how much industrial land will be developed for non-industrial purposes. We don't know whether some of the residential land inside our boundary will be developed much more intensively because some of the lot size restrictions that are in place may be subject to having property owners have a right to build even more intensely. We don't know how much of the development will occur outside of urban growth boundaries in rural areas as rural property owners present their claims and have them acted on. So we're trying to figure out what happens next. We're engaging with our local governments. We're setting up some studies. We have a tremendous amount of resources available through our Data Resource Center. 4 years ago when Measure 7 was being discussed and what possible improvements, changes could be done, we did a lot of work with our data center and supplied a lot of maps and detail down to the legislature. We're prepared to do that again and to let you have the benefit of whatever factual data we can put together that for dealing with the one-third of the state's population that's located in the Portland area. And lastly, I think that while this is an issue that is separate from the question of what happens to the future of the land use planning system, it also shows that we may need to take a little time out from having to move an urban growth boundary in a very specific cycle, the next one which is due only 2 years from now, and catch up with what's happening and take into account what Measure 37 really means and what changes are going to be made as we go forward with that. So with that, I'll stop and let these two go on, and if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, well, let's save those questions. Did you have a question? Okay. Who wants to go next?
Chango and Richard Gerard. My name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And a session ago or so, I had the opportunity to spend 8 months dealing with Measure 7 in the legislature. So I wish you well at this point. And I'm probably going to be with you all the way. I've handed out a paper that was written back in November, shortly after Measure 37 passed. And this paper was given to the AOC membership at our conference in November, and it provides a kind of a summary overview of the measure, and in the latter part of the paper identifies issues and questions with regard to the measure. You've already heard a number of those here this afternoon. I won't take the time to go back over those. Let me just share with you a couple of things. First, I think you know that counties dealing primarily with land outside urban growth boundaries are subject to regulations that we have adopted that come directly from state statute or administrative rules. I would dare say that 90% of the regulations that counties have adopted, either on farm, forest, or rural lands, come directly from either statute or administrative rules. We have them, we administer them, you've asked us, we've done the job. And now we have Measure 37. So one of the issues that we have been talking about in terms of our coordination with Lane Shutterly, you know, is what happens when a county waives a regulation that's in their zoning ordinance and it is derived from either statute or administrative rules. What action will the state take? Will we get sued? You know, will we get enjoined? What will happen? And we don't have an answer to that question yet, but hopefully we're working on it. Counties are encouraging property owners to file that files a claim with the county to also file a claim with the state because of what I just said. Because the regulations come from statute or administrative rules. Now, Wayne Charlie earlier told you that the states received about 69 claims. Well, we're somewhere up to 150 to 200. So there's a lot more claims filed at the county level than there are filed with the state at this point. And I would clarify and characterize the claims that have been filed with the counties basically dealing in two categories. One, I want to build a house on a piece of property that I've had. And two, I want to divide my land. And somewhere in the 70s or 80s, or maybe even in the early 90s, the zoning was changed on my property that limited my ability to subdivide or partition my property. Those are primarily the two areas that the claims that have been filed to date would fall in. We're in the process, AOC is in the process of trying to get from the counties all the process and procedures dealing with Measure 37 that have been adopted by counties. I will tell you that not all counties still have formally adopted a process or procedure or an ordinance dealing with how Measure 37 claims are filed, but they may do it in the future. And we're also trying to have all the claims, you know, come into AOC so that we can begin to characterize those and see where they would fall.
If you can get one more minute, please.
That's fine. And I thank you for that. The other thing that I would share with you is that I've gone to most all of the Major 37 forums and attended meetings with countless attorneys, and the one thing that I've found, and you're seeing it today, is there are many more questions than there are answers. And each time we have another forum, there's more questions identified. And so I would just, you know, we would be good to take a breath to understand all those questions before we go out and start trying to find answers for maybe even questions that will be in conflict with the question that we identify tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicated there are, 30 in the metro and 150, 60, say 200 properties. Would you estimate how many, just guesstimate, how many of those properties, how many homes would be built at this point? Is it mostly subdivision? Is it mostly onesie, twosie?
Chair Guard, Representative Anderson, I would characterize about of the claims. About half of the claims are filed for one house on a lot, okay? But then you have other claims that vary in terms of land divisions from as small as four or five lots to one in Hood River that is for in the hundreds at this point.
So we're still found in maybe 400 or 500, under 1,000 actual buildings, more than likely.
Today, Representative Anderson, could very well be under 1,000.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of ONCs. I'm not going to take a lot of your time. From League's position with Measure 37, primarily for our 240 cities, is to be an information bearer to them. We've been doing that through multiple listservs. We have a website. If you haven't seen it, please take a peek at it. It's probably got the largest body of information on 37. We've been sending out these advisors. There's four issues here with information as it comes to us, both in terms of questions that we've been asking on the muni level, the county level, and our conversations with the state and other interested constituents. As Mr. Schlack indicated, there's been a lot of discussions, a lot of panels going on. I, for the league, have been maintaining those communications with those. There's been various meetings with other associations, joint county city attorneys meetings, the city of planning directors have met, as well as the county planning directors have met. A lot of communique. In terms of claims, we're seeing, as far as inside city limits, only about 10 to 15% right now with the available claims. I agree, we need to take a breath, but we have 180 days marching on, and that does mean something to cities. We are looking for some clarity, either legislatively or judicially, in terms of implementation, how to resolve some of the uncertainty that we feel in these forums, it does exist within the text of the measure. I've handed out another piece to you of issues or questions. There's about 25 or 30 of them here. These are the ones, these are not necessarily from the league's position per se. They've been collected through development attorneys, through the county conversations. These are the ones that have come up most often. But there's probably about twice as many. But again, this is an informational piece to you, not to spur immediate action, but to give you some sense of what those questions might be. I've been asked by many of you for more information. Lastly, I'd like to say we have been meeting in cooperation, as you heard from Lane Shetterly, weekly with the state and the AG's office, looking at the coordination and implementation issues. Those have been very, very good meetings. We've been assured by Lane in his role through DLCD that cities and counties looking at finishing up periodic review work tasks that may have Measure 37 liability attached to them, that DLCD will be working with cities and counties in terms of the timeline to figure out how to best work within the scope of those work tasks. There are, however, and I'm scratching my head here, I do have some concerns with some agency rulemaking that is going on to date that we don't really know if it will bring additional local government liability under Measure 37 and potentially some state liability too. There is some rulemaking going on within DLCD with the Goal 14, Goal 9, potentially some of the designation of new freight routes and DEQ, some new TMDL standards and stormwater management plans. So those are some open questions for local governments here, whether those get answered within the scope of that rulemaking or later by the judicial system, they are still open-ended questions for us.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Bob Stacey.
Chairman Ringo, Jim Gerard, Bob Stacey, Executive Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. It's a minute to state, you know, to the clerk, it's really longer than you can get through in 5 minutes, and you can read it in August or September when you have more time. Let me make the three or four points I would in the time available. First, the first headline in that prepared statement says, listening to the voters. 1000 Friends of Oregon was part of a broad coalition which lost big in the November election. Twice, Oregon voters have spoken, encouraging, insisting upon changes in our laws. We need to listen carefully to understand the message that's being submitted, being transmitted, excuse me. The second headline is the word humility. I sincerely hope to proceed with humility this legislative session on behalf of my organization, both in seeking a solution and in listening to the will of the voters. What I hope we do not rush into, and I guess I would echo to that extent John Chandler's remarks, is a conclusion about exactly what the voters intended, which may go beyond that intent. Not to read into it that which we wish the voters we have met. I have my wishes, supporters of Measure 37, I have others. There are opponents of land use planning who read into it a general call for relaxing or even undoing our statewide land use planning laws. As Mr. Chandler said earlier, there is very good evidence that Oregonians continue to support land use planning. They hold both of these ideas. They support land use planning. They want government to treat property owners fairly. Those ideas don't have to be inconsistent. They don't have to be irreconcilable. We, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, opposed Measure 37. And there are many aspects of it that we do not like in its apparent operation. But we do believe the voters intend for land use regulation, indeed all government regulation, to be more fair. And we are intent on working this session to find ways to improve the fairness of the operation of the land use planning laws. We urge both your committees to take the time to look at the concept of compensation. There are two approaches in Measure 37. One of them isn't funded. This is not a request that you look to the general fund resources of the state of Oregon or to the taxpayers of the state of Oregon to find new tax dollars to award compensation to property owners. But it is a plea to think about the cases that you heard from Mr. Schumann, that you heard from Senator McPherson, farmers who won't be able to simply suck it up when a development occurs on their fence line, who will be injured. Our great concern about Measure 37 is that the waiver process is fundamentally unfair to the neighboring property owners who are affected by the waiver, the clearest example perhaps being farmers across a fence line. Can we find a way to make our existing land use laws fairer? Can we find a way in some limited set of cases to award compensation to property owners funded through the gains, the unusual and outsized gains, that some do accomplish as a result of our land use planning process? And I think particularly of those property owners whose land is included within a new urban growth boundary expansion. We are interested in working toward exploring those kinds of approaches to finding resources to provide cash compensation, development credits, or other mechanisms for property owners who are adversely affected by looking at that small subset of property owners who are richly rewarded by a land use planning program. We do believe that continuing under Measure 37 as it's drafted, as opposed to replacement legislation which develops an improved process, continuing under Measure 37 will lead to harm to neighbors in an untenable situation for local government and the state. There are regulatory approaches that may be part of our future. Communities need to continue to have the ability to plan and to consider changes to their zoning. In late November, in one of the bulletins that Linda Ludwig talked about, the League of Cities advised its member jurisdictions to stop action on planning and zoning. That means Oregon goes from a state where, whether you like it or not, we were considered by most as a leader in the land use planning process, to the one state in the union where cities and counties cannot use zoning to address community problems. I don't think that's a situation we want to leave in place indefinitely. One final remark. Mr. Chandler spoke about the so-called Big Local 30-year review legislation. We think that is the ideal mechanism for taking a top-to-bottom look at our land use planning laws, to revisiting the statutes that were first put in place by Senator McPherson in the 1973 legislature, the statewide planning goals that arose under those statutes, and the reams of state regulations and local plans and regulations that have implemented those. We do have a complex program. Many Oregonians have lost touch with the reason for that program. Many Oregonians have not liked the touch of that program on their development aspirations. There is much to learn, both about the successes and the failures of our Ladies Printing Program, and much opportunity for improvement. I think that's another area where these two committees can profitably spend time. I'd be glad to answer any questions of the committee.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thanks very much. Let's get some ag guys up here. Don Schellenberg and Scott Ashcom.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. As many of you know, Oregon Farm Bureau did not take an official position on the 37 as it went through the process. Having said that, there is significant concern by part of the farming community about what will happen. And you've heard the comments about checkerboard planning now under Measure 37. That's a concern to some. Others who see it as an opportunity that they didn't have before. What are some of the things? How do we address this issue? What do we do with Measure 37? How do we implement it? That's the big question. Again, you've heard many of them say how there are actually more questions than there are answers at this point. That's where we fit into this program as well. I would make a comment regarding the farmers' assessment issue. Probably we will need to do something along that line. My understanding is that in order to receive farmers' assessment, an EFU zone to qualify for what's called automatic farmers' assessment, that is, the agriculture producer doesn't have to apply on a yearly basis, doesn't have to meet an income test. In order for that zone to qualify, the county cannot allow non-farm uses that the state law does not allow. So if a waiver is granted by the county that does allow them a non-farm use that the state does not allow, then what happens? It appears to us that the zone would be disqualified and that each of the growers in that zone would then have to apply on an annual basis for farmers' assessment and have to meet an income test. I don't think probably the assessor's office is going to like having to deal with all that paperwork as well, and then in addition, it's an extra burden on the agriculture producer. So I think that's one area, probably not an area maybe that this committee might deal with, but an area that I think we're probably going to maybe deal with. Compensation is an issue. We strongly support compensation, financial compensation. The issue that we've never dealt with is where are you going to get the money if you're going to do financial compensation? So I would say that's an issue that Logan Farm Bureau is going to take a look at as well. That's maybe all I'll say at this point, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Scott Ashcom with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. I want to just support everything that Don said. In addition to that, however, our organization has a concern with the need that Measure 37 has brought about for an expanded notification provision in our land use laws. I handed out some testimony to the committee that contains a draft bill, and I stress a very rough draft bill, some legislative concepts, which I'd like to ask the committee to authorize committee staff to get this drafted as an LC draft to kind of clean it up and rationalize the language in there a little bit. We'd like to come back and ask for this to be introduced as a committee bill. What we're concerned about is that we now have Measure 37. We don't think it makes much sense to second guess the voters on this. This is the law. We have to live with it, at least in the time being. It creates a situation for many of our farmers that have been receiving special farm use assessment. They've owned this property for a long period of time. Measure 37 has passed, and an individual farmer might believe that he has a claim for compensation. So he files that claim for compensation under Measure 37, which basically is a wide open claim process. We're asking in this draft legislation that the county, for example, notify the individual claimant for a Measure 37 claim within 60 days of the filing of the claim, whether the county intends to compensate or whether the county intends to waive the regulation. If the county intends to waive the regulation, we want the county to notify the claimant that whether or not the county intends to regard that claim as the waiving of that regulation as a change in use of that land. Because a change of use in the land under ORS 308, one of the revenue property tax statutes, triggers the property tax penalty that you heard about from Senator McPherson earlier today. And that property tax penalty can be quite significant, 10 times the difference between what the property was assessed at on the market under a farmer's value assessment and what it would have been assessed at on the market value assessment. That can be a pretty fair chunk of change. So we want the county to notify the claimant that deferred property tax penalty may well be due, and then give the claimant an opportunity to withdraw his claim for compensation. And this rectifies the problem of maybe an unintended consequence of Measure 37, where the claimant might not know that he's going to have back taxes due if he files that claim. And secondly, going to what Linda Ludwig was talking about in Art Schlatt, we believe that a state agency should notify a county or a city when it is about to adopt an administrative rule change, such as a change to go 14 or go 9 by LCDC, that might result in compensation claims for the county. It's only fair, it seems, that LCDC or a state agency, or for that matter even a county or a city, should do a market value impact analysis for every tax lot in the impact area of a proposed zone change or UGB change to determine whether or not the adoption of that rule change or the adoption of that zone change or the adoption of that UGB expansion may trigger a compensation claim or the waiver of a regulation in that jurisdiction. And we ask that the government body making that proposed regulation change that could trigger the compensable claim be filed with the Department of Administrative Services on their Measure 37 website. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Committee? Okay, thanks. How about Ray Wilkinson and Tom Gallagher, please? You guys aren't together, but
we're not together. He's just slower than I am, so
you don't have to come to the table at the same time.
We're still not together. Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Tom Gallagher, and I represent a group that you're going to hear more from called the Urban Developers Coalition. And I'll just make a couple of brief and quick remarks on this bill. The first one is I really think this committee should deal with 37 in a number of ways, and most of them are in process. We do property transactions. We want to build and develop and redevelop land. We want some certainty as to what property rights transfer when we buy the land. I think some of the mortgage bankers and the bankers are going to talk about the uncertainty of doing due diligence and lending on this property. If you don't come up with some sort of criteria here that gives us some sort of certainty as to what rights transfer under the waiver, if we have to go through the judicial system to figure that out, we could be a significant number of years before some large property transactions takes place in industrial and commercial land. That's job growth and job development. The second thing I want to talk about is the difference between state and local waivers. I think we should have a process to bring those two procedures together. I think Art Schlatt talked a little bit about that. Filing both with the state, filing with the local, what happens when some individual property owner does all of this stuff and then a year and a half from now tries to sell his property. Most of the stuff we've talked about is in the past is residential. A lot of records, subdividing to build some houses on. We're talking about property that is close to services, close to transportation, flat ground that people want to develop industrial sites on. I'm a little bit nervous, but I can see different developers going out on a major 37 rights hunt, trying to find a piece of property that has 37 rights because it is in a more developable area. Some of the processes will be more, it will be easier to get through. And I think this committee should take a look at developing some statutory language for how that happens, for how property is transferred, what rights are transferred, what uses are transferred, what certainty there is going to be on that property as it goes through its successive layers of ownership. I think the last thing I'll say on that is at least some sort of knowledge, if we go to develop on a piece of property that has major 37 rights, how much involvement does the property owner have to have? What kind of legal, organizational, and business schemes can take place on that property? My group just hates the idea of this going through the court system. Poor case after poor case, a number of different iterations of the same type fact situation, the wrong fact situations coming up first. So we are actually looking forward to this committee taking a hand on this legislation, especially inside the urban growth boundaries or on other property that can be developed for industrial and commercial purposes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ray? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent the owners of roughly 5 million acres of private forest land in Oregon. We do not have any specific suggestions for you, at least not yet, on how the legislature might respond to the passage of Measure 37. What I've passed out, and I can just briefly comment on, is our view of what a Measure 37 might mean for private forest land in Oregon, and I can do that fairly quickly. By way of background, I think it's important to note that OFIC members, we're not of one mind, just like the Farm Bureau isn't, but generally speaking, we have been supportive over the years of the land use planning process, or at least accepting of it. Frankly, the rural residential and intensive forestry are two land uses that don't mix very well in a lot of cases. It's kind of oil and water. People move out to the forest if they can, and then they're unhappy with some of the practices that their industrial forest land neighbors engage in. A lot of conflict over logging, use of herbicides, the view shed, that sort of thing. In addition, from our perspective, development in those areas both increases the risks of forest fires and also makes it much more difficult to put out fires once they start, in terms of where you're going to put in a fire line, where you're going to backfire and that sort of thing. If you've got houses in the way, it makes it very difficult. So because of those fairly pragmatic reasons, I think primarily we've been willing to accept restrictions on residential use in lands designated for forest use over the years. Also, like the Farm Bureau, we did not take a position on Measure 37. We were preoccupied with another ballot measure related to the Tillamook Forest, and we decided just to focus on that and not get engaged in other ballot measures. Several of our members, however, has been reported in the newspaper, were major supporters of Measure 37, both in spirit and also financially. And the questions have been asked, what was the reason, why did they support that? And again, that was probably a subset, a minority of our members, but there was a significant contribution to the effort. Nevertheless, what they have said and what they mean is that they did not do so because of a desire to immediately run out and convert their lands to subdivisions. They were instead looking at what they believe is an insidious attrition of their private property rights and private property values over the years through regulatory restrictions on the use of their land, and that this was designed as a firewall to prevent that continuation of loss of value. Again, even on the regulatory side, they are not looking to turn the clock back to file claims. There will be exceptions to this. Some people will, but by and large, you're not going to see a lot of claims filed to get compensation or waivers for the application of existing regulations of forest land. It really does go to the future. That's their main motivation. Some people have doubted this, and they said, well, if that's what you meant, why don't you write it that way? Write it prospectively rather than allow for retroactive claims. All I can say to that is I know that some of the major members that support Measure 37 frankly haven't owned their forest land long enough to take advantage of Measure 37 even if they wanted to. Those recent acquisitions preclude that sort of a thing. A good example, and this is not a company supporting Measure 37, but an example where Measure 37 would not apply
Illinois would be the acquisition of Lavin Industries by Weyerhaeuser just 2 or 3 years ago. That's a 500,000 acres, most of it, almost all of it in Northwest Oregon, where the population pressures are, and none of that property would be eligible for compensation or take advantage of Measure 37, even if Weyerhaeuser wanted to do it, and I don't believe they would just because it's so recently purchased. Since December 2nd, my understanding, there's only been 3 claims filed based on Forest Practices Act regulations. 2 are very generic. 1 is has a public safety issue, will almost certainly be not allowed to go forward. And that's another place there will be a limit on how this measure affects forest land. The public safety, public health and safety, public nuisance, the compliance with federal law, exceptions to Measure 37, all those are going to play out somehow. We don't know how yet in terms of how it affects Measure 37.
We just need to wrap up in a minute.
Right. And for several reasons there, I guess my conclusion would be that it's not likely that Measure 37 will have a huge impact on private forest land. We have historically been accepting and supportive of the Forest Practices Act and its rules as long as it remains reasonable. We've historically supported reasonable land use planning for the reasons I indicated. A lot of our land is too remote to be developed. It's not suitable for development. It's way out in the boonies and it's steep and it's just not developable land. And a lot of it has not been owned long enough by its current owners to take advantage of Measure 37 even if they wanted to. So I think the impact on private forest land, nobody knows for sure about Measure 37, but right now it doesn't look to us like it's going to be significant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Boss, you want the last word here? You're responsible for this, aren't you? No,
Mr. Chair, I think 1,050,000 Oregonians are responsible for this, not one lawyer from Tigard. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ross Fay. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs at Oregonians in Action. I'm one of the co-authors of Measure 37, and I'm proud of it. Measure 37 passed in 35 of Oregon's 36 counties, 27 of Oregon's 30 Senate districts, received more votes than any other measure ever, any other citizen-initiated measure in the history of the state. I think,
Ross, I would like to just focus you on, just because I do want to get out of here in 5 minutes, but I'm happy to hear that. But one of the things I really want you to answer is what you think this committee should do. And we just heard a lot of discussion about some people wanting clarification, whether it's the counties or the cities or the realtors, for example, and I really appreciate your response to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the point is, measure passed overwhelmingly in the state. The idea that we should do anything, I think, suggests is coming from folks who are trying to find ways to get around Measure 37, for the most part. Are there technical changes that need to be made? Perhaps. This idea about are waivers transferable? I mean, you want another revolt? Just say to the voters that what you guys passed wasn't really what you thought it was. If you want to know why Measure 37 passed, all you got to do is listen to Director Sherrill's testimony earlier today about how it's going to be a non-conforming use or something less than a non-conforming use. I mean, that's exactly why the voters passed the measure. I would suggest that we let the measure work itself out. The only folks who are raising these quote-unquote ambiguities are the folks who are trying to get around the measure. The voters' intent was clear, despite what the opponents of the measure said. 61% of Oregonians recognize something fundamental about our land use system, something that this legislative body has failed to address. It's unfair. What the voters said on November 2nd couldn't be clearer. They wanted to make it a fair process. Measure 37 does that. Now, if there are folks here who don't like the fact that we can now remove or not apply regulations to somebody's property, well, they should have mounted a better campaign, I suppose, to the measure. But the fact of the matter is that the measure is perfectly clear on many of the points that have been raised, many of the questions, the quote-unquote questions that have been raised. And I think to suggest otherwise is to put your head in the sand and ignore what the voters said on November 2nd.
second. What I would like to see the committees do, instead of addressing Measure 37, why don't we address some of the issues that give rise to Measure 37 claims? Some of the inequities that have occurred as a result of Oregon's land use planning system. The Dorothy English's situations of the world, where you've got somebody who's lost absolutely everything. Why is it that we're going to dance on the head of a pin and discuss whether or not waivers are transferable when we've got people out there who can't live on their property but their horses can? I mean, it seems to me like it would be better suited for this committee, for these committees, to address the real issues of Oregon's land use planning system than whether or not any interest therein applies to trusts, and if it's irrevocable trusts or revocable trusts. I mean, that just seems to be a waste of everyone's time. If the committee and if the folks sitting behind me are really interested in addressing the issues, I would suggest to you what we do is address the actual problem, which is Oregon's land use system. Let me be perfectly clear on this. In December of 2003, we did a poll. We wanted to find out what Oregonians thought about the measure before we went forward with Petition 36. 52% of the folks who had any experience with Oregon's land use planning system, 57%, said Oregon's land use planning system was barely fair or poor. Of the people who had an experience with Oregon's land use planning system, 77% said it was terrible. 5% said it was excellent. We're assuming those are land use planners. But for the most part, Oregonians don't view this morass of laws and regulations as fair. I would suggest, rather than tinkering with what the voters overwhelmingly supported in November, I suggest to the committee, both of them, that instead you address land use laws themselves. I'd be happy to answer any questions about any of the points that were raised during the last couple of hours. However, I will say this. There has been a change since Friday, and that is a lawsuit was filed. And so being that I will likely become a party, or actually represent a party in the lawsuit, I'll be limited in what specifically I can discuss. But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, just one question. On the basis of your testimony, I think it's apparent that this measure is before this body. Does your group intend to participate in this legislative process, or do you prefer to sit on the outside?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I don't think Measure 37 is before the body. I think it was before the voters on November 2nd, and they overwhelmingly supported it. With that being said, our policy has always been and always will be, our door is open. We're willing to sit down and talk with whoever about whatever. But the question that was put to me was, what do you think we should do about Measure 37? And my answer is pretty simple. Nothing.
Thank you.
Just a comment. I think there are a lot of smart people that did not oppose Measure 37. They're not against you. If we read the words of Measure 37, I mean, what became law was not the ballot title, it wasn't the campaign slogan, it was the words that are included. That became law. And there's a lot of smart people who think that those words do not permit Dorothy English to subdivide. So I submit to you that even if you want to carry out her intention, if you want this committee to fulfill the intention of the voters when they voted yes on Measure 37, which I do, I think we do need to look at it. And that's where I hope this committee goes, not trying to thwart the intention of the voters or undermine the intention of the voters, but to carry out the intention of the voters, because I agree with you that we need to look at why they voted for Measure 37, but to say we shouldn't do anything, I don't think is realistic, and frankly, I don't think it does a service to people who supported Measure 37, including Dorothy English.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, I couldn't agree with you more. If the committee wants to do something to advance the intent of the voters, certainly we'd be well behind it. And I think the voters were perfectly clear that they intended, for instance, waivers, which by the way is a term that's not in the measure itself, but for lack of a better term, they intended that waivers be transferable. If the legislature wants to pass a bill that makes them transferable, certainly we'll be make that point clear. Certainly, we'll be more than willing to work with you on that point. But the suggestion that they're not, I think, it certainly belies the will of the voters.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee, anything else for the good of the order? Well, I almost got us out at 5, a little bit late. Thank you, everybody in the audience, for your participation. Thanks to the committee. Thanks to the generous participation of our House colleagues in joining us. And that'll close.